We negotiated with him for about 6 or 7 hours, and he did come out of the vehicle. The female came out with him.
A standoff in front of Fairbanks Memorial Hospital ends peacefully. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 23rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how expanding the largest gold mining company in the world could affect the Donlin Mine.
There are very few gold deposits of that size and scale in the world anywhere. So I think you have to look at that and say there's a lot of value there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
A 7-hour standoff outside Fairbanks Memorial Hospital yesterday was resolved peacefully. Fairbanks police report receiving a call after 9 a.m. Monday about a suicidal man with a gun. He was in a car near the hospital emergency room entrance. A woman was in the car with the man, and it's unclear if she was there willingly or if either were hospital patients. A city special weapons and tactics, or SWAT team, and a state trooper special emergency response team deployed to the hospital. City police spokeswoman Yumi McCulloch says law enforcement successfully talked the man into surrendering without anyone getting hurt.
We negotiated with him for about 6 or 7 hours, and he did come out of the vehicle. The female came out with him, and he was detained by law enforcement officers, and he was brought into the hospital with the officers and hospital staff.
The situation forced security measures at the hospital, including alternate access to the emergency room. McCulloch credits the hospital's handling of the all-day standoff.
The staff at the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital were phenomenal. They were very cooperative and helpful. They provided food and drinks to the officers outside and inside, the negotiators inside.
McCulloch thanks hospital patients who were cooperative in working around police operations. At a city council meeting last night, Mayor Jim Matherly noted the volatile nature of standoff situations and recognized how the hospital incident was handled.
Sometimes the choices the person makes in that predicament decides the outcome. And in this case, they were able to communicate and bring it to a peaceful resolution. So I'm very proud of everybody who worked on that.
The standoff prompted security measures in the neighborhood surrounding the hospital, including at area schools where doors were locked and alternate transportation routes employed after school. Police say no charges will be filed against the man. A federal civil rights suit filed against the city of Fairbanks has been dismissed. U.S. District Court Judge H. Russell Holland's ruling released Monday dismisses the suit filed by Native men known as the Fairbanks Four. George Fries, Marvin Roberts, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent allege racial bias-driven police misconduct, including coercion of false confessions and fabrication of evidence that led them to being wrongfully convicted of murder. New evidence pointing to other suspects in the 1997 beating death of John Hartman resulted in a fall 2015 hearing and an agreement with the state, which vacated the Fairbanks Four convictions but stipulated that they were validly obtained at the time. City Attorney Matt Singer says Judge Holland's ruling hinges on the fact that the agreement does not meet a key legal stipulation for filing this type of federal civil rights case.
The kind of civil rights claim is not allowed unless they have first established their innocence before the state criminal court. And what Judge Holland ruled is that the Fairbanks Four, by settling their case and acknowledging that their original convictions were valid, they had not obtained a favorable termination.
If the question is, was the criminal case favorably resolved, the charges were dismissed and the convictions were vacated, and that's about as favorable as you can get.
Fairbanks Four attorney Mike Kramer says the Four will appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court in the hopes of getting a more favorable opinion. But he notes that it's a 2-year process, another legal delay for men who spent 18 years in prison.
They're used to justice proceeding very slowly or not proceeding at all. And so, you know, they took it well. They understand this is going to be a long process and certainly not over yet.
Kramer says the Fairbanks Four case is unique in that most other release dismissal agreements involve charges, not convictions. The city's Singer says he expects a similar determination if the case goes before the Ninth Court.
Judge Holland followed the precedent set by the United States Supreme Court and by our circuit appellate court, so I would expect the Ninth Circuit would agree with this decision.
Judge Holland did not decide on the broader issue of the validity of the 2015 Fairbanks 4 agreement with the state, under which the men also agree not to sue, but now say they signed that under duress. Canadian company Barrick Gold is the biggest gold mining company in the world, and a proposed merger with another large gold mining company in South Africa would make it even bigger. The merger could have implications down the road for the proposed Donlin mine in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Barrick is a 50% partner in the project. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger brings us this report from Bethel.
Barrick Gold wants to build one of the world's largest gold mines in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Andrew Lloyd is the head of Barrick's communications, and he says a proposed merger with another gold company, Randgold, would make the company even more powerful.
For Barrick and Randgold, it's an opportunity to bring together a collection of assets that will create the world's largest portfolio of what we call Tier 1 gold mines.
Tier 1 gold mines are ones that produce a lot of gold, have long lives, and low costs. But what does this merger mean for the proposed Donlin mine? Barrick owns 50% of Donlin Gold, the company developing the mine. Another Canadian company, NovaGold, owns the rest. The Donlin mine would be a massive open-pit mine. And if completed, Donlin would be in the top 10% for gold mines in the world because of its deposit size and production. That makes it a very valuable asset for Barrick.
There are very few gold deposits of that size and scale in the world anywhere. So I think you have to look at that and say there's a lot of value there.
But it's located in one of the most remote regions in Alaska. That means it will need a lot of infrastructure. It will need roads, a gas pipeline, a power plant, and a port. And that makes it very expensive for Barrick to develop. The Donlin mine will cost $6.7 billion to build. That's according to its 2011 feasibility study. And right now, Barrick and its partner NovaGold are trying to crunch the numbers again to see if the Donlin mine is worth that kind of investment. In 2011, the feasibility study says Donlin might be too expensive for Barrick to develop based on the market prices at that time. But Lloyd points out that gold mining is a cyclical business.
Gold prices rise and fall over time, sometimes dramatically. And so when you're making an investment decision that might span decades, you want to be sure that that operation will be sustainable over the life of the mine.
Donlin has been moving through the permitting process after receiving its environmental impact statement from the Army Corps of Engineers in April. It also received many of its most important permits from federal and state agencies this year. That means Barrick and his partner NovaGold can start planning an updated feasibility study. That study will be one of the final steps before the companies decide to build the mine. Donlin isn't the only big project in Barrick's portfolio. Lloyd says that Donlin is comparable to two of the proposed mining projects in Chile, and he says they had to shut down one of them because of costs and environmental concerns. But Lloyd says Barrick is serious about developing Donlin.
The challenge is finding cracking the nut to develop in a way that will work for all parties. So again, that's very much what the owners are focused on, and I would say taking it very seriously.
Right now, Barrick is focused on completing its merger and its current mining operations. Lloyd says doing that will help them find more cash that could help them invest in their proposed projects like Donlin if it moves forward. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Northwest village is using a new renewable fuel source to offset high fuel costs.
I think it's going to be a really good renewable energy source that we can use, the sun.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
New poll results show a much closer race for governor after independent Governor Bill Walker suspended his campaign last week. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman has the details.
Pollster Ivan Moore of Alaska Survey Research found Republican Mike Dunleavy is leading Democrat Mark Begich by 4.6%. The poll was taken Friday through Monday. Dunleavy led in a poll taken a week earlier by 17 points in a three-way race that included Begich and Walker. Moore's latest poll results say that 5% of voters plan to vote for Walker even after being told that Walker ended his campaign and endorsed Begich. The poll results say that Walker wouldn't help Begich if he actively campaigned for him. Begich lost ground to Dunleavy in a question about how Alaskans would vote if Walker actively campaigned for Begich, talking particularly about the gas line. In Anchorage, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Imagine spending more than $1,000 on your monthly electric bill. In parts of Alaska, that's a reality. In the state's most remote areas where villages generate their own power, electricity prices can be more than 6 times the national average. One Northwest Alaska village is about to switch on a new solar project to try to insulate itself against swings in fuel costs that can cause electric prices to spike. Its backers hope the project can be a model for the rest of the region. But there are also obstacles to setting up cutting-edge technology in rural Alaska. Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk flew to the village of Buckland to take a look.
When I get to Buckland, the group of visitors I'm traveling with goes to find the mayor, Tim Gavin Jr. He's doing some work at a burned-out church. We pull him away and he puffs on a Marlboro as we walk to City Hall. Once we get there, the visitors who are helping the village with its renewable power project pull out a box of donuts for Gavin. Donuts are a hot commodity here in Buckland, where there are just a few tiny stores.
Donut jelly still. I love donuts.
Pretty quick, though, everyone gets down to business. Gavin has a contract to sign. The village is getting paid for some equipment and labor for the new power project. Then he and the visitors start talking about what will happen once the village's new solar panels and batteries are turned on. Gavin's thinking about whether there can be a special price tied to the renewable power.
So we can have a diesel rate and we can have a nature rate.
That'll be hard to calculate, though, because you get nature rate throughout the year.
Why wouldn't we even know?
You end up with a...
Winter rate and summer rate.
There's still a lot of details to iron out. But soon, the village is planning to switch on 3 new solar arrays for the first time. Buckland is hundreds of miles from the road system, so the equipment was shipped by barge up the river that runs past town, the same way the village gets the diesel it uses to generate power now. By summertime, Buckland is planning to install a set of batteries to store extra power generated by the solar panels and some existing wind turbines. Once it's all online, there should be stretches of several hours at a time during the summer when Buckland will be able to turn off its diesel generators altogether. That's a pretty big deal given the price of diesel and heating oil in Northwest Alaska. In Buckland, gas is $7 a gallon. Elsewhere in the region, it's even more expensive.
Well, we pay $8.25 for gas and $8.25 for heating fuel.
That's Billy Lee, a tribal leader in the village of Shungnak. He says he used to buy $5,000 of fuel every year to heat his home. But recently, the local borough, as part of a test project, installed something in Lee's house called a heat pump, which runs on electricity instead of fuel. Lee says it saves him $2,000 a year. The heat pump starts to seem pretty compelling when you look at what's happening in Buckland. And if you imagine that villages like these ones can produce more of their own renewable power without shipping in diesel to run their generators. Here's Lee again, talking about solar power.
If we can educate our kids not to bust all them panels and keep them going, I think it's going to be a really good renewable energy source that we can use, the sun.
But there's still a lot of obstacles to be cleared before solar, wind, and batteries can be expanded beyond Buckland to Shungnak and the region's 9 other villages. First, heat pumps are expensive. Second, a big chunk of the money for Buckland's renewable system is coming from grants, and it's probably unrealistic to expect the same kind of cash to materialize for more villages. Third, it's easier to install the renewables in Buckland because the city runs its own utility. Most of the other villages in the region belong to a big rural electrical utility, the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. The first thing is just proving the concept works, says Sonny Adams, who works on renewable energy projects at Northwest Alaska's Regional Native Corporation. Adams helped put together the Buckland project, and he talks about it as we walk around the new solar arrays. The village's diesel generator hums in the background.
Yeah, you want to demonstrate it. And the nice thing about Buckland is they wanted this, you know, it came from them.
Later, back at his office in Anchorage, Adams says he wants to be careful about people's expectations for renewable power in Buckland and elsewhere. It's probably not going to slash electric prices overnight, What Adams is shooting for is protecting villages against spikes in the price of diesel and heating fuel. The goal, he says, is to level the playing field between rural Alaska and the rest of the country. Northwest Alaska villages still aren't connected to the state's big electric grid or to the road system.
You know, when I look at the lower 48, I travel, I look at all these roads to nowhere, you know, and I see all these transmission lines all over that. And I think to myself, how did they pay for all this? You know, and we're not asking for special treatment. We just want what they have.
Buckland's solar arrays are set to go online later this week. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
Alaska Native tribes and tribal health organizations have joined a federal lawsuit against the prescription drug industry over the opioid crisis. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
Alaska Natives and Native Americans as a whole are fatally overdosing at a higher rate than the rest of the U.S. population. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control. Rob Sanderson Jr., a leader with Tlingit and Haida in Juneau, said addiction often starts on prescription drugs. When the supply of prescription pills runs out, people turn to the street.
You see people that would never have thought get addicted to heroin. It's everywhere. You see it with the rich, the poor, and the in-between. You see everybody.
Nearly 450 tribes have filed briefs in support of the plaintiffs in a lawsuit targeting the opioid industry. Jeffrey Stromer is an Oregon attorney helping direct the tribe's legal efforts.
I mean, this is an epidemic and a crisis that is devastating Indian country. Proportionally, to a much greater degree than the crisis is having an impact in other parts of the country.
Legal experts say this federal multi-district litigation filed in Ohio now involves more than a dozen states, thousands of municipalities, and hundreds of tribes.
And that's different from some of the other large-scale litigations that people have compared this case to, most notably like tobacco litigation.
Adam Zimmerman is a law professor at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He said that 1998 settlement ordered the tobacco industry to pay more than $200 billion over 25 years. But that settlement mostly went to states. Alaska Governor Bill Walker declared a public health emergency over opioids last year. But Zimmerman says it's clear tribal councils don't want to leave it up to the states if and when it comes time to share any global settlement.
They note how tribal sovereignty is very, very, very different from the kind of relationships between a city and a state government or state and the federal government, and how important it is that they have a seat at the table to make sure that the needs of the Alaska Natives and the other Native American populations that are represented are adequately served.
Tribal health organizations in Alaska have also filed suit. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, known as SEARCH, operates clinics in at least 20 communities down Alaska's panhandle. Stromer said tribal health organizations are on the front lines.
SEARCH, just like other tribal health providers in the state, has seen an increase in resource allocation focused on addressing the impacts of the opioid crisis.
The increasingly complex opioid lawsuit is in the hands of a federal judge in Cleveland. With the list of plaintiffs growing by the week, it could even surpass the 1990s tobacco case to become the largest lawsuit in U.S. history. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The highway connecting Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula will close at night periodically over the next 2 weeks. Over 2 weeks, rather. The Alaska Department of Transportation says culvert work will close the Seward Highway south of Girdwood in six-hour increments for parts of six nights. The first closures at miles 84 and 86 will be Wednesday and Thursday. Closures are also planned for 4 days next week, October 29th through November 1st. Department spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says the closures are planned between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Crews could work longer than 6 hours if they run into unexpected issues. Emergency vehicles will be allowed through, and the work depends on the weather. Wind gusts to 50 miles per hour hit Tuesday, forcing work to stop. Well, Monday marked the start of early voting in Alaska's general election. In addition to voting by mail or in person on Election Day, Alaskans can also vote at designated early voting locations across the state. And this year, they'll get an extra prize for voting early, one of Juneau artist Pat Race's custom-designed stickers.
I think it's an enticement to get people to come out and vote early. So these stickers are only available if you vote before Election Day.
The new I Voted stickers feature cartoon versions of Alaskan animals in iconic settings. They come in English, Spanish, Tagalog, and several Alaska Native languages. Ray said the Division of Elections first approached him about illustrating the cover of the election pamphlets sent to voters. They liked his design so much they decided to turn them into stickers too. Division spokesperson Samantha Miller said the contract with Race totaled $5,000. She said the division has also paid for election pamphlet art in the past. Race said he hopes this will serve as a pilot program for future elections.
I'm hoping that I can work with the Division of Elections to talk more about that after the elections and develop some guidelines for other artists to participate and maybe make this a tradition.
Race is also selling prints of the designs at the Alaska Robotics Gallery in downtown Juneau. The traditional blue and gold I voted stickers will be available on Election Day.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Homer's local needle exchange wants to install disposal boxes in bathrooms around town so residents can safely dispose of syringes. The volunteer-run organization provides free sterile syringes, life-saving Narcan kits, and on-site HIV and hepatitis C testing, among other services. Dr. Sarah Spencer oversees the exchange and says volunteer staff have been discussing this project for a while.
People will come to us with news or complaints about finding improperly disposed syringes, like finding syringes on trails or on the beach or in public places and that kind of thing. And so we've been thinking that it might help to reduce those reports of inappropriately disposed syringes if people had more access to sharp disposal containers.
She says it isn't just people using illicit drugs who are in need of sharp disposal boxes. People who inject insulin and other medications also need safe locations to dispose of syringes. Spencer says the exchange will likely start with a pilot program consisting of roughly 10 boxes around Homer. She says the program will survey its clients to decide where to place the boxes.
Where they think hot spots are, especially folks who may be transient or semi-homeless, or here in the summer, who don't have necessarily access like they do to come to the exchange, where would be places where they would be most likely to inject or to need to dispose of injection supplies.
The exchange would provide the boxes and would take responsibility for emptying them. Spencer says the exchange will be able to lock the boxes so people won't be able to reach into them. She adds that the cost to purchase and maintain them is relatively low. However, the money isn't secured yet. The demand for exchange's services has far outpaced its grant funding. Right now, volunteers are using their own money to purchase supplies. The organization hopes to secure more funds through a GoFundMe campaign. If the exchange raises additional money beyond what's needed for supplies, Spencer says they hope to install the disposal boxes in January. A new medication-assisted addiction treatment clinic called Ideal Option opened in Juneau, and it's different from many of the other treatment facilities in town. For one, it's a for-profit model and advertised aggressively on Instagram and Facebook prior to opening. Ideal Option doesn't currently offer in-house counseling, and that has some in Juneau's addiction treatment community worried. KTOO's Kavitha George has more.
The existing addiction treatment facilities in Juneau feel encouraged that Ideal Option is here to help tackle the problem of substance abuse.
The addiction problem we have is significant, and having multiple providers in our community like we already do is essential to ensuring that people get served and people have options.
That's Bradley Grigg, Chief Behavioral Health Officer at Bartlett Regional Hospital. Ideal Option in Juneau is part of a chain of medication-assisted treatment clinics. There are more than 50 locations in the lower 48, as well as branches in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai, and Wasilla. The Juneau facility offers a wide range of treatment services, but currently does not offer in-house counseling. Counseling is not a mandated part of treatment. Addiction specialists say it's best to start a new patient on medication, even if they don't want counseling, and hopefully added in later. But Grig and other health experts say it is an essential part of helping facilitate recovery. Jeff Allgaier is the CEO of Ideal Option. He recognizes that there's suspicion around medication-assisted treatment, that it just replaces one drug with another, as in the case of Suboxone treatment for opioid addiction. But, he says, Ideal Option clinics follow the most up-to-date practices of his profession.
Our goal has always been to try to follow the most up-to-date evidence-based guidelines and not sway from them.
And at their clinic near Nugget Mall, Ideal Option staff seem eager to start helping Junoites struggling with addiction. Sarah Martin works there as a medical assistant. She moved from Kenai to help open the Juno clinic.
The company in general, it's just what they're doing is just amazing. And I love it. Like, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go open this clinic. Yeah, I want to go work in this clinic just because new patients are my favorite. I love getting people in. I know that sounds weird, but I just love when they come in because they're the excitement of I want to get better. And we can offer that for them.
In addition to individualized medicated treatment, CEO Allgaier says every Ideal Option location offers case management services to help patients with things like finding legal services, housing, and employment. As far as counseling goes, Ideal Option clinics in other states have integrated departments they call Ideal Balance to provide behavioral health services, and they're working with the state to bring that to Alaska. Here's Allgaier again.
If I could add it tomorrow, I would, but there are hoops that you have to go through.
The process of licensing an in-house counseling agency could take 2 to 6 months. In the meantime, the clinic is referring patients out to the community for counseling. But this approach has other providers in Juneau concerned. Registered nurse Claire Suzanne Geltoff says that it's a big ask to send someone struggling with addiction to a second appointment for counseling.
It seems like very fragmented care. I think it's in the client's best interest to kind of receive a robust model under one roof, if possible, like many other options are in Juneau.
Geltoff organizes regular meetings for the multiple addiction treatment facilities in town. Despite her reservations, she says she's still looking forward to building a relationship with Ideal Option. Other providers in town have also expressed plans to reach out to Ideal Option to collaborate in addressing Juneau's opioid crisis. In Juneau, I'm Kavitha George.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross, Tim Ellis, and Robin in Fairbanks, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, Nat Herz and Andrew Kitchenman in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick, Kavitha George, and Adeline Baxter in Juneau, and Renee Gross in Homer. Our audio engineer is Ammon Swenson. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state, from Valdez, Utqiagvik, and more. Information at flyraven.com. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.